Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the AlbumReview.net podcast. I'm Greg Potters. Thanks to all you listeners out there for your interactions and feedback. Your feedback is much appreciated and it helps me to always improve. On today's episode, you are in for a treat. This is my first live in the studio interview and album review. Now, this episode was previously recorded, but my guest, author, business owner, and music aficionado Kyle Hegarty joined me in the studio as opposed to over video conference. Kyle's joined me twice before, first to discuss his highly educational book, The Accidental Business Nomad, A Survival Guide for Working Across a Shrinking Planet, and a second time to review Guns N' Roses' debut, Appetite for Destruction. You can find that review at albumreview.net and hear the podcast, which was broken up into two parts, on the website and wherever podcasts are available. So today, Kyle and I are going to continue the trend and do a full album review of the EP album that followed Appetite for Destruction, GNR Lies. Now, Kyle called me from Singapore and recommended that we do this, so I got to give him the credit for the idea, but just to remind you all, you can read all my reviews and listen to any of my podcast episodes by going to albumreview.net. These episodes can also be heard wherever podcasts are available. And in addition to this, you can read well over 30 written reviews at albumreview.net and pick up some merchandise from your favorite bands. I've got t-shirts, albums, sound systems, and as I mentioned before, I've mentioned on pretty much the last like 10 or 15 podcasts, the bookstore. It's not too new anymore. So you want to learn more about your favorite musician or band and you just don't want to go looking for it on the internet or you can't find it on the internet? Go to albumreview.net and click on the store tab where you can grab a copy of different biographies and autobiographies. These are some of my favorite things to read. I've got autobiographies and biographies from artists such as Faith No More, Eric Clapton, Motley Crue, Pink Floyd, Eddie Van Halen. I've got the interesting story of Spotify, how it became, Tom Petty, Metallica, as well as books from previous authors that I've interviewed on this show. Okay, so I had a heck of a time mixing and editing this, but I'm fairly happy with the end result, so bear with me on any sound issues, but the recording you're about to hear is significantly higher quality sound than the product I first had to work with when we hit stop on the record button. Hey, I've had to learn how to edit and master video and audio on the fly, so go cry somewhere else, all right? All right, enough chatter. Sit back, relax, go to 7-Eleven and grab some Night Train and listen to Kyle Hegarty and I review Guns N' Roses' 1988 release, GNR Lies. Joining me today on the AlbumReview.net podcast is business owner and author Kyle Hegarty. Kyle was previously a guest for parts 1 and 2 of our review of Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction. Kyle's joining me live today here in the studio all the way from Singapore to review Guns N' Roses' second studio release, GNR Lies. Now, before we dive in, I wanted to remind the listeners, Kyle wrote and published a book titled The Accidental Business Nomad, A Survival Guide for Working Across a Shrinking Planet. You can get a copy of Kyle's book by going to albumreview.net and clicking on the bookstore tab, not the podcast tab, bookstore. Kyle, thanks so much for being here in person, coming all the way from Singapore. It was a long flight, I'm assuming, but he's joining me here live in the studio today. So thanks for being here, man.
You're live like a suicide. I had a direct Singapore to New York flight, 18 and a half hours.
Just for that? No,
that's
just kidding.
How long I've been thinking about this album.
He's had time to prepare. Yeah. How is he? And you're not jet lagged at all still,
I'm
even
all
though?
Over the place. I'm fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 12 hour difference. So right now it is It is like 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. So Kyle's on his 85th cup of coffee today. I'm on my 84th. So he's got one on me. So he's back in Boston visiting family for the holidays. And he, like I said, joins me here live. This is my first live two-person album review. And as I mentioned, Kyle works and lives in Singapore, where he is the managing director of TSL Marketing, which is a global consulting firm that helps businesses grow their sales and marketing capabilities across new markets. And at TSL, Kyle runs the cross-cultural leadership division, where he helps clients such as Salesforce, Google, Lufthansa, INSEAD, did I get that one right?
INSEAD.
Thomson Reuters, and Microsoft, and helps them wrestle with their global growth challenges. So Kyle is also, I struck a gold here. He's a frequent speaker and trainer around the world. MSNBC, CNN, The Straits Times, Singapore Business Review, Fortune Magazine, and other online publications have featured Kyle's work. So I stole that directly from your bio on Amazon, Kyle. You probably know that already. As great as all this is, Kyle is also a huge Guns N' Roses fan, as am I. And Kyle and I go way back to before high school. And then we formed the infamous, fabulous hard rock heavy metal garage band back in 1991 that today is still one of my fondest memories. So,
In our last conversation, I think you had suggested that I had been kicked out of the band or something like that.
I think we had a disagreement or an argument about that. Like, you were the Vince Neil situation where you claimed...
I was telling my family that I got kicked out because I just wasn't doing enough drugs. I was the anti-Steven Adler of the band.
It was the first time in history where a member was kicked out for not doing enough drugs. Or any. And so while we were all drinking Jolt Cola and putting Pop Rocks on our tongues, because that was our version of drugs back when we were 14. No, we've talked about this before. We go way, way back, and it's just, I think the last time we were together in a music room was probably 24 or 25 years ago. So this is really special. So we're going to talk today about Guns N' Roses' second studio album, or EP, titled Lies, or what some may also call GNR Lies. So this EP was released on November 29th, 1988. And today...
Almost to the day.
Are we almost to the day? Yeah, we are 2 days off. So I looked up the difference between an EP and an LP, Kyle. And what I found is that, and I should know this, but whatever. An EP is short for long playing. Duh. And generally has more than 8 tracks on it.
An LP,
right. Yes, long playing. Whereas an EP has roughly between 4 to 6 tracks. And although there are 8 tracks on Lies, side one, as many may already know, is a re-release of the band's early 1986 live release, and I want to talk about that in a couple of minutes, called Live Like a Suicide.
There's already some lies ahead of us.
And I many times I'm going to dig back into how I misunderstood a lot of the things on this. So for the first couple months when I owned this, I thought it was Live Like a Suicide. So that was one thing. And I'll also talk about the title later. But Kyle, I can remember when this album came out in 88 and how excited we were. It's a really unique EP because it has 2 completely separate sides. Why did Guns N' Roses, to your knowledge, decide to re-release Live Like a Suicide and then just add it to this? Do you know?
I think money.
Money?
I don't think it was their choice. I think this was just Geffen. I think Geffen Records, my understanding is that they saw this band on a rocket ship because Appetite was starting to really take off.
Right.
And they looked at them and the way they were behaving. And they go, these guys are not going to survive. Put a microphone in front of them and do whatever it takes to get another EP, LP, whatever you want to call it, out. And so actually, I think that's the reason why that thing was done. It was done from a Geffen, I think, pushed it. And as corporate and annoying as that sounds, it was a hell of a good decision.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, we're going to go into the songs in a little while here, but it's totally different from side two, which is the actual Lies. So it's just, I think, describing this to someone who's never heard it, and my guess is most of the people listening to this out there at least have heard of this. But it was, as a younger kid, I was just getting close to becoming a teenager. It was confusing because I was like, wait a second, like, What live? So this part's live, but this isn't, or is this live? And why is this all acoustic and this is not? So I had a lot of fun diving back into this as I do a lot of other albums. And this time in particular, I can't remember the last year or month or date that I was blasting Lies in my house, like on a regular basis. So it was, it just reminded me back of those days. So
yeah. And if you, I was thinking about the album in two ways. I was thinking about it today as we look back on it, but I was also thinking about it at the time, which I think is really important because our, you know, we were there in the, in the moment, right?
Young,
whatever, we were 12 or whatever, we, however old.
Yeah.
We were.
I think we were 11.
And that's a time as I think you've discussed in other sessions where that age group is where music really sticks with people.
Yeah.
But if you think about back then, without any internet or anything, the only thing most of us had ever heard were those 12 tracks from Appetite.
Right.
So anything.
Anything extra. Yeah.
That had anything to do was just gold.
Yep.
And that was what was so exciting about it.
Yep.
When it came out.
Yep.
Nobody knew what this band was all about.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So Side 2 was the last studio recording with drummer Steven Adler. In 1990, Adler was kicked out of the band for what Guns N' Roses stated was excessive drug use. So this just cracks Colin up over and over and over again, and even to this day as I think about that. I think it's pretty hypocritical that they kick Steven Adler out. Now, if you... Kyle, we talked about this in the last podcast. If you hear Steven Adler today, he's definitely struggled with some trauma, physical brain trauma from his drug use. And so I guess it got to a point where the other members were at least trying to get off the drugs and alcohol, and maybe they weren't fully off it, but, you know, Adler was... You know.
My understanding is the way the band rolled was you did whatever you wanted as long as you didn't bring
show up
mess into the moment of actually
show up and do your best. But if you jump off the Empire State Building between gigs, as long as you're not as long as you arrive,
you couldn't separate the two.
Right.
They did. So he's on Civil War, right? So he's the last. That's he. His work is on Civil War from Use Your Illusion.
Yep.
But they patched together from like 32 takes.
Right,
he couldn't keep it steady,
right.
And that was the end of it.
Oh man, I don't know if I knew that. Wow. So he actually was involved. Civil War was an earlier recording though, right? It was an older song.
They fired him. It was early days of recording.
The Use Your Illusions? Yeah. Okay. Interesting. No, that makes sense.
I would say this. The Side B of Lies, I believe, was the last time the five of them were recording in a studio.
Today. Yes. Yep. That's right. Yep. I think it's You're Crazy that I think has. Well, we'll get into that in a minute. So for this EP, Sides 1 and 2, you can still hear, as Kyle was saying, Steven's really brilliant rock drumming that carries, I think, many of these tunes. So. Getting into Side 1, which is, again, as we were talking about, Live Like a Suicide, it kicks off with who I thought, Kyle, was originally Duff McKagan yelling to a live audience, "Hey effers, blank are beeping blanks, you bleeping bleepers." And then I looked deeper and I read something that it was Slash yelling, "Hey effers, bleep on Guns and effin' Roses." For 33 years, I thought this, and I didn't realize it, but Kyle tells me today, as we're prepping for this podcast, that it's not even Slash either. Mind blown.
Roadies. This is setting the tone for the first side of this album, right? This is raw, rude, punk, old school stuff.
Totally.
Coming in and laying it out there. Now, I think you're alluding to the fact that they've got, it's called Live... They've got crowds going crazy. Do you want to get into this?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
I didn't even know this.
What I didn't realize was the crowd noise that you hear in the background. It's a real recording of crowd noise from their concerts, but it's mixed into the song. So the recording you're hearing is actually a studio recording, but they mixed it with, and what they're claiming is their own crowd noise from previous concerts. But I'm still, my research might be a little
It's weird that they did that. you know, because they were supposedly, it came out as, no, let me ask you this, was Live Like a Suicide, did they have that in there, or did they add that for?
So I'm going back through my notes here, Kyle, and actually I just contradicted myself. What I found was the recording was a studio recording. They took crowd noise. It was real crowd noise, but it was from Duff McKagan. In his autobiography, he wrote that it was from a crowd recording from a 1970s rock festival called the Texas Jam with two X's. Duff wrote in his book, "We thought it would be funny to put a huge stadium crowd in the background at the time when we were lucky to even be playing before a few hundred." So when I first heard this, I'll never forget thinking, like, it opens, it Reckless Life opens, you know, side one. And I remember thinking, like, wow, you know, these guys were huge. Even famous back in like 86 when this first came out. So as a young kid, it definitely fooled me a little bit.
My understanding is that they went into a cheap recording studio in 86 and they just smashed out these and a couple of other songs.
Yeah.
But they did it actually live, quote unquote.
Right.
They were all just doing it together.
Right.
So it wasn't like they were, you know, all doing separate tracks.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
It does have kind of that feel. It's pretty basic.
It totally does, yeah.
But
yeah.
There's nothing live. There's no, this is not live.
No, and so a part of me felt a little betrayed, and then another, you know, like the business side of me was like, you know, that is kind of interesting. That is kind of smart, because it got me, right? So the band rips into the first track, Reckless Life. Now, this is a punk song, wouldn't you say, Kyle?
Yeah, punk with kind of like an Aerosmith 70s blues feel to it.
Yeah, I think it's punkier than anything that's on Appetite. It's just raw and heavy.
Yeah.
And like our previous review of Appetite, Kyle and I go deep into the punk influences that brought Guns N' Roses to write and record the music that they did, and then really change the direction, as we talked about. By the way, I'm going to make a lot of references to our Appetite for Destruction podcast, so after this, you guys will have to go back and listen to that one. But I think Guns N' Roses really changed the direction of hair metal and hard rock really forever. We had the conversation last time about how Nirvana really changed things. And I said that, or maybe it was Kyle, actually said that it was really Guns N' Roses that started that trail. Nirvana was really kind of more the knockout punch.
Yeah, I think the Guns N' Roses stuff killed glam rock.
Yeah.
Hollywood glam rock stuff. And this one is that weird transition. So I'm sure, you know, Axl was with his hair all tasseled at this, you know, all done up. And,
up
and on. They were still doing that in 86 and 87. But this is not glam rock.
Not at all. Music. No, it's punk. And what I didn't also know is that some of these songs are covers. So Reckless Life is kind of a cover song. And I say kind of because it was written originally by the band previous to Guns N' Roses, which was called Hollywood Rose. And it included all the members of Guns except for Duff McKagan at one point. So I thought that was really interesting. But again, just a punk song right out of the gate, fast, loud, aggressive. And I remember as a kid thinking to myself, like, wow, this is definitely heavy compared to, you know, what I was going to encounter on side two.
And I think that's very deliberate. Right.
Yeah.
So almost the complete opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we get into side two, it takes a completely different direction. So the next song, Nice Boys, is a cover of a song by the band Rose Tattoo.
Down the road to blue.
I thought this was also another sort of concoction of previous Guns N' Roses members, but it's not. They're an Australian rock band, yeah, formed back in Sydney in 1976. And I think this is kind of a, I was listening to it this morning, it's kind of a swinging rock song, if you know what I mean, Kyle. It definitely sounds like something you'd hear at 2 a.m. at CBGB's in the basement, you know, like the Ramones, Patti Smith, and Rose Tattoo.
I don't know if I like or not like this comment about the first two songs, they have almost the exact same tempo.
They do, yeah.
I find it kind of confusing.
Yes, yes.
These two songs blur together.
I had the same feeling when I went back and listened to it, and even the first time as a kid, just... like, oh, are these the, is this the same song?
Yeah.
They're just now saying Nice Boys. I think Axl's voice really gives Guns N' Roses the spark that gave them the individuality and difficulty tagging their genre earlier on. The original version by Rose Tattoo, it's a little bit grittier, which I didn't think you could get there. It's definitely, like I said, a 70s punk song. And many of the punk tracks from that era had the British accent added, you know, or affiliated into them. While going back and researching this album, I forgot. This is a good track. It's simple. It's repetitive. It's catchy. Nice boys don't play rock and roll. And but it's not something where I could see myself, you know, after maybe the fifth listen, I'd be like, all right, let's move on to the next one. No offense, but it was good, catchy, but... I think there's stronger tracks on the album.
Agreed.
Yeah.
This is why it's a proto Appetite.
Yes.
Songs, right? It's like pared down, sort of simplified, and I like that because it's done before Appetite. So it's really, from a fan standpoint, it's like, okay, here's where we're coming from.
Exactly. Yeah. I just remember having difficulty piecing it all together in terms of timing, because I was like, well, this is a new release, but this is from 86, so wait a second, but this is live, so and again, I chalked that up to just some naivety from a 10 or 11 year old. But
I have vague recollections of friends saying that they had the original
oh man, I've got the best one. I was going to talk about it later, but I had a friend of mine at the time who thought that the song by Fleetwood Mac, "Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Sweet Little Lies, Tell Me Lies," that was Guns N' Roses, and that the name of the album was called Lies, 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 because if you remember on the cover, Lies is written three times in the newspaper. So I remember feeling all strong and mighty when I was in the playground playing on the slide and the swings, and I was correcting him that Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Sweet Little Lies was not by Guns N' Roses. So, but I'm going to get more into that in a little while, but that's just one of my fondest memories that makes me laugh still to this day. And that was like 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. So Move to the City, the next track, is in some ways the only really original Guns N' Roses song on side one. Now, again, I say sort of. This track was written by guitarist Izzy Stradlin, who famously left Guns N' Roses at their height right after the band finished recording their long-awaited double LP, User Illusions 1 and 2. Now, Move to the City features a horn section, which is unique, I think, for a mid-80s hard rock punk band. So that's what I really dug about this song. It was kind of Aerosmith-y, you know, in a way. I've always learned, just add THY to the end of any word and it perfectly makes sense. So this is another really strong track. And at 3 minutes and 42 seconds, like a lot of the other songs, it goes by fast. But I had a great time going back and listening to this. And from, you know, 88 until probably 1990, it played constantly on my Iowa stereo. my Panasonic boombox and my Sony Walkman for sure.
I would say this is my favorite song on the side.
I would agree. Album,
I think it's got a cool swing to it.
Yeah.
This back in the in 86, I was rereading about this, was their big song.
Yep.
And they used to jam it. And they would just go and kind of play around with it.
Right, yeah.
And you get pieces of that if you listen to the live double album that came out in the 90s. Because they kind of just do... He introduces the band, and the band does like a horn solo thing. But I guess they used to do that in 86. I don't think they were horns, but this was their sort of fun jam out. This was like the big song for them in 86.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting that it didn't make Appetite. I always thought of Move to the City as like... the younger brother of Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah, totally. It's a shame that they didn't adopt the horn section for more of their, you know, more of their shows. I mean, I don't recall, and I've seen them in concert, I think it was 3 times, and twice back in the day, and then once in like 2017 when they did the reunion tour, but I don't recall them using any horn section in any of the concerts that I saw, or even on you know, when I saw them on TV at Rock and Rio or whatever. And I wonder why they, because I really dig that sound. I think it's a cool sound that, again, not really any bands were doing back then, except for like Chicago, but Chicago was a band from the 70s.
No, so. That's why it's such a cool combo of, again, we keep saying this is such a punk album.
Yeah, yeah.
And but you've got Slash's blues going the whole way, and so this punk blues combo, yeah, put in horns, that's cool.
Yeah,
favorite song, definitely my favorite song.
Mine too. The fourth and final track on side one, Mamakin, it's an Aerosmith cover. So that's, again, it's going back to Move to the City. That's really the only kind of pure original from GNR. So I have my thoughts, but what are your? I've got a couple items to add to this.
I was going to compare your answer to Axel's answer because he announces the song very inappropriate.
Oh yes. This is a song about your bleeping mother.
Turns out it's not.
I can. Once again, some of my fondest memories are like being in the car driving with my parents, and they had already taken Appetite away from me, so I had to go buy another copy. And this was all cassette back then, because this predated when I even had a CD player. And when Mamakin would come on, hearing Axel say, "This is a song about your bleeping mother," I obviously had to be manning the volume switch in the car very quickly. So sometimes I'd have to reach from the back seat or make a really loud coughing sound. This is a cover from Aerosmith off their very first album, 1973 self-titled debut, Aerosmith. And I got to admit, originally when Lies was released, this was the first time I heard this version. In 88, the bulk of my knowledge of Aerosmith was Ragdoll, Dude Looks Like a Lady, and Angel.
Yeah.
Thank you, MTV. And I remember a friend of mine telling me that this was a cover, and like many experiences listening to covers, liking this version really forced me to dig deeper into the Aerosmith catalog. You know, in 88, Kyle, I know you and I, you know, we shared a liking to a lot of their earlier albums, but in 88, when Pump came out, that was a big deal, I felt. That was probably their last really, really...
Permanent Vacation came out in 88, and then Pump in
90. Permanent Vacation was 80, I believe 87, and I think Pump came out at the very end of 88, like right around New Year's 88, 89, and that's the album that blew up even... bigger than Permanent Vacation. So it was clear that Guns N' Roses was a big you know, they had a big Aerosmith influence, and they because they said this in a lot of interviews, and I believe their first major tour that they ever went on, they opened for Aerosmith in like 87.
So it would have been after this recorded, this was done. But I mentioned it at the beginning. I think Reckless Life. That just sounds like 70s Joe Perry.
It really does. Yeah. It made me really fall back in love with Aerosmith again and go back and listen to, because I had heard, you know, I had heard Dream On. Dream On has got to be next to Stairway to Heaven. Dream On has got to be one of the most, and Smoke on the Water, some of the most, and I love them. I love them all three, but some of the most overplayed songs on the radio, at least back then. So I had heard those songs a million times. When I went back and listened to Aerosmith's debut album, then it, you know, I found just a ton of tracks on there that made me dive deeper into their catalog. The only album I would say, I don't want to go too far into Aerosmith, but the only album I would say that probably wasn't their strongest was an album called Done With Mirrors. It wasn't incredibly phenomenal, but again, Aerosmith, Kyle, they're a band that Guns have cited as one of their major influences, and was also, like I said, the band that they opened for in 87.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but which version of Mama Kin do you prefer, the Aerosmith or the...
I've got to go with the original version by Aerosmith, and it's mainly because Tom Hamilton's bass, and as a bass player, I feel like he really drives that song. But then this song taught me, or gave me, a lot more appreciation for Joe Perry. And then, as you were saying, Kyle, with Move to the City, with the horn section in the original Mama Kin as well, I thought that was, so I would have to say that song. But for a good month or two, I thought that Mama Kin was a song written by Guns N' Roses.
I believe on the Lies album, it said everything was written and recorded by Guns N' Roses.
Really?
Yeah, I seem to remember that. I'd have to break out your cassette.
Every once in a while, I would get unlucky, and the cassette I would purchase would just have that unfolded. Like, it wouldn't even be, it would just be one piece of cardboard. They'd basically hose you on the whole inlet thing. It would only happen every once in a while. So you'd open it and it would just have like Geffen Records 1988 or 8, whatever the year was.
This was a fun album as that age to look through.
Yes.
It had that tabloid stuff going on and all these goofy headlines and these weird.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and Kyle, you bring up a good point. I wanted to touch upon or maybe dig deeper into the fact that in the 80s, I was really drawn to music that represented, you know, teenage angst, strife. You know, as I noted in our Appetite reviews, the moment that I heard and saw musicians who symbolized rule breaking, torment, adversity to compliance, a tractor beam just kind of pulled me towards all of it, and I never really looked back. I never believed that I chose this kind of thinking. It really chose me in a weird way. It always just had kind of been a part of me, and I won't torture the listeners by turning this into a therapy session, but I think it's important to discuss. And I also think this is why Kyle and I made a connection 30 plus years ago. Well, many of our friends, you know, I don't know, I don't think many of them got it when they listened to this music. We were really drawn to it. I mean, I can remember being at a party and we excused ourselves because Guns N' Roses was releasing the video for November Rain. We were at John Casey's house. And so while like everyone's in the backyard, we were like, we have to find a television right now because November Rain video is coming out. So I don't know. I think music for both of us has always been and still is our therapy. So for those of you with children nearing or in their teenage years now, I find it incredibly challenging, but definitely educational and humbling to experience it now really from the other side, as Kyle and I are both parents.
Remember we talked about the studies that say that music gets kind of burned into people at this age, right? Between the age of like 8
absolutely.
And 12. I don't know what the studies have said exactly, but it's interesting now having kids in that bucket going, wait a minute.
I'm so aware of that, and I'm trying not to influence them too much.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
I just think one day they're going to hear something in college in somebody's dorm room and be like, whoa, this is cool. Oh, I remember my dad listening to this. So those are just some of my some of the things I think about when I go to bed at night. But watching your kid go from an innocent toddler, Kyle, to someone who's, you know, forming their own strong opinion, having trouble with your opinions and needing you less and less, it's hard. It's hard to deal with. And I think there's also, you know, that reality in many ways that they no longer understand or relate to you. At least not right now. They're kind of in that phase. I believe that, you know, these things shall pass. However, I think it's really difficult from both sides to go through this. And I've got to give credit to where credit is due. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, they weren't kidding when they said, parents just don't understand. Yep. Because my days as a GNR fanatic, I think I can understand where my kids are coming from when their world is full of confusion. And that was the tie I wanted to make, you know, to bring back to just, I think, why I was kind of drawn to some of this music. It wasn't because I really had a tough life per se. I just, we both were going through kind of a confusing time. And middle school is really a time where kids are just trying to navigate what the hell's going on every day, you know?
Agreed.
So
And just to tie back to this first side of this little EP, whatever an EP is still, I just think that, I wonder, are these scraps from Appetite, are these the ones that didn't make it, especially on the first side? So if you remember, we talked about how, you know, side one is really just about violence and life and,
yeah,
and slimy kind of bad behavior and drugs and violence.
Yep.
All of these songs are like that as well.
Yeah.
Kind of with the exception of Mamakin, but I think they kind of make that a little grimy as well.
They
but
definitely do.
It's like a mini side G version of Appetite.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, I think this was definitely during their heyday, or maybe not their heyday, but when they were growing into their heyday, when they were still partying 24/7. I mean, God, approximately how old must they have been in like 86?
I think they were in their very
early 20s. Yeah, so I mean, like, who didn't, you know, who didn't damage their self?
These guys were taking it to the...
They were taking it to it, yeah, a way another level. So,
I do like these four songs. I think together they're just kind of a fun. They fly by,
mm-hmm.
right? They must be what 15 minutes in total or less.
I think each of them average about three and a half minutes long.
Yeah.
So if you multiply that by four,
minutes,
they fly. Yeah,
this is the word that keeps coming up when I was thinking about this whole review, which was Lies is a bookend on both sides to Appetite. In other words, this first side is the...
Oh, yeah.
This brings us... This is like... This kind of intros us to where Appetite is coming.
Yeah.
And then the second half, which we'll get into now, is kind of where they want it, where they're going or what they're thinking about.
Yeah.
Another angle. And I like this idea of just kind of thinking about it as bookends. And in a more of a pessimistic way, arguably, this is the best that we're ever going to hear from them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of a down. It's unfortunately, there's not really much, in my opinion, that comes after this that's at this level.
I think we could definitely have that argument.
Sorry to go negative.
No. It makes me think, actually. You make me think about the bookends thing. Actually, I've got to clean my brains off from the back wall here because you just blew my mind. But it's really true. Like, yeah, if you think about it, there's, you know, nowadays in TV and even in Hollywood, there's so many prequels. That's like the hot thing now.
Yep.
It's like, just write any story and then do a prequel. And you can, because sequels have kind of been overplayed, and they now, there's sort of like a joke connected to, you know,
yeah,
Friday the 13th part 94,
right,
you know, but if you go back, you know,
you
do, yeah, like Jason's mom when she was a little girl, you know, like crazy stuff like that. So but I think it's interesting because you can really, the world is your oyster. And so to think about this as kind of being, hey, this is side one is the prequel to everything.
Yep.
When the band first got together, this is what they were working out. And then they really honed their chops during Appetite. And then Lies was their next...
So
you know,
Appetite comes out in what, early 87?
Yep.
And it doesn't really do much commercially for months.
Correct.
Then they start taking off.
Yep.
And their lifestyle is already crazy, but then you add money and growing fame and it gets crazier. And so this is where I was saying, you know, Geffen said, put microphones on these guys before they die.
Yeah.
And yeah. They got him into a studio early. I think it was January of 88. I think they did this in a day, maybe two recordings. They did it live.
Yeah, you're right. I think I have some data on that. You're making me go back and think from memory. I remember it not taking them very long to record. So, diving into side two, what can I say about side two of Lies? I mentioned it earlier, but I want to mention it again. I can remember the album cover looking like a newspaper with 30 to 40 different breaking stories, all of them on it, which were about Guns N' Roses. As a kid, it took me a couple hours to realize that it was just a fake newspaper, because at first I was like, whoa, what newspaper is this? Kyle, you may remember the word Lies appears several times on the cover in the bottom left. It appears three times. And as I said earlier, a bunch of kids that I remember hanging on the playground with were like, oh, do you have Guns N' Roses' new album, Lies, 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 Lies? And I was like, I think it's just called Lies. And we would have that argument, you know, and I could picture my mom coming and picking me up and being like, this argument's not over. I'm getting in this car, but this argument's not over. To add that, I can remember a classmate of mine, as I said earlier, thinking that Fleetwood Mac's song Little Lies, tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies, which at the time when I was 11, to me personally, and I don't feel this way anymore, but it epitomized like dentist office rock. Like that was stuff that made me think about going to the doctors.
One idea just on the title, which this is like another warning sign of Axl Rose's paranoia and craziness, which is just everybody's always out to get him.
Yeah,
there's lies about the band. They say we do all this stuff. It's like, okay, like you guys live a pretty disgusting life, and like, okay, but they're lying about this. Okay, fine.
Yeah,
and he's always angry.
Yeah, I know. Oh my god.
And so this is another kind of beginning clue of where his behavior goes in the future, right?
It really is. This was probably when, I think this is really the album when Axl starts to kind of quietly take over kind of ownership of the band. It's interesting because it happens, I think, in every band. And in many cases, some of the members are just like, you know what? I just don't have the energy to fight this. Whereas other members are like, okay, you know, I have disagreements, but I want to stick together. So it really is kind of like a marriage. You know, it's like, well, I remember loving them 10 years ago. And so even though we're having trouble now, maybe we can work this out. But you're absolutely right, Kyle. I think this is the beginning of Axl really starting to, I don't know, kind of come into his own way and,
you know, go in his different direction. But let's get into the side B, because I think just from the get-go, Patience is like, I don't know, I can't remember the first time I heard it, but it is the complete opposite of anything that we'd heard from him before.
It is.
Right?
It is.
It really is a calm and gentle and beautiful. I think it's a beautiful song.
It's a beautiful song. It's the gold staple of the EP. It's a chart-topping single. The music video was definitely overplayed, but it was really the first Guns N' Roses ballad, and it shocked me when I first heard it.
Cause I'm missing you, I'm still alright to smile. Girl, I think about you every day now. Was a time when I wasn't sure, but you set my mind at ease. There is no doubt you're in my heart now. Woman, take it slow, it'll work itself out fine.
Again, I'm waiting for, I'm putting in side one. I'm not fast forwarding to side two. So I'm thinking for the first 15, 20 minutes that the stuff I'm hearing on Live Like a Suicide is brand new. And then I flip the tape and I hear Patience. And I never thought my favorite band at the time would write an acoustic ballad. Within the pop charts, this song blew up, Kyle, if you remember. It was huge. It was everywhere. And within about 1 year of the release of Appetite, Guns N' Roses had another mammoth hit on their hands. So they had gone through the Welcome to the Jungle, The Sweet Child of Mine, Paradise City. There might have been one more. And then, video-wise, and then this one blew up.
Was that they were just, Paradise City and Patience were stacked on each other.
They were,
like,
yeah.
This weird, funny overlap of two albums on the, you know, number one and number two.
Exactly. It was the first time in a while where a band had two albums, like maybe since the Beatles, where they had two albums in like the top 10, but it was, this really made Guns N' Roses become the biggest band on the planet.
I think so, I agree. And to Geffen's credit, I think they forced it. I couldn't find any quotes from any of the band members.
That I would believe that, were
thrilled,
definitely.
Excited or proud of this album. Like they kind of, it was kind of just forced upon them.
I think that's why Geffen is considered a genius. In some ways, many considered him a hard ass and not a nice person, but you know, I saw the Geffen documentary a couple of years ago, and he's clearly, business-wise, a genius. And so I can believe that, definitely. I mean, the way he got Guns N' Roses started, he had one of the guys, we talked about this in the last review, he had one of his guys in Geffen call a connection that he had at MTV and said, just give us Welcome to the Jungle, play it once the next five nights. Just play it like at midnight. And that was it. Then the Appetite took off and it all originated. Apparently, according to legend, it really kind of originated there.
I'm smiling because the other story I had heard, I have no idea where I heard this, was that the people would call in to request it, right?
Right.
So they came in and people started calling. And the, what was it called? The call, back in the day when you'd call in and there were all these multiple lines, they all lit up, right? The story was that there were so many that calls, like something, one of the wires frayed and actually caught on fire. So it literally caught the thing on fire. I don't know if that's too good to be true.
That's an awesome story. I don't know if I could totally believe that, but if that actually happened, then they've got bragging rights.
In some ways, Patience is such perfect timing because there was such chaos on this rocket trip and they were just launching into, you know, the biggest band of all time.
Yeah.
And then this very calming sort of ballad kicks in.
Which is like, really cool. Right, and we all know kind of like, what do most rock, you know, what did most rock stars admit to the press why they wrote ballads?
Just to get the girls.
Pulling the girls. Yeah. I mean, Poison, they were geniuses at that. And so now, you know, one of the things that Metallica, they admit, struggled with in the 80s was 99.999% dudes. And so when they put the Black Album out and they had, you know, Nothing Else Matters and Unforgiven, then they started seeing a little bit more and a little bit more. And they started literally analyzing at the end of every show, like, I saw more women tonight. This really brought the girls to the Guns N' Roses concerts as well,
I think, Axl, if you think about his later work, everything he was doing, all the stuff that he was really interested in were ballads.
Not ballads,
but like very much.
Well, Elton John, we talked about.
John's,
yeah.
Stuff.
Yep.
So you've got Estranged. You've got when he was obsessed with November Rain, which he'd written a long time ago. But
right.
He spent forever trying to work on it.
Yeah.
All of the things that he cared about were actually heading in that direction.
That's a great point, man. I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right. You know, as kind of nutty as Axl is, he did have a soft spot. Yeah. Now, in terms of Patience and who wrote it, there's conflicting stories out there. Some say lead singer Axl Rose wrote it. Some say Izzy Stradlin, their rhythm guitarist, wrote it. Either way, it's a masterpiece. Why? Why do you say? Although the band played it live as an electrical version with drums constantly since it was released in 88, the album version, as Kyle and I have been talking about, is void of any drums or percussion. So if there's like maybe 1% of you out there who've never heard it, because I find that hard to believe that there's anybody who hasn't at least heard Patience once, it was all over the radio back then. It just consists of three straight acoustic guitars. And this one, Kyle, brings back so many memories for me. Going to middle school dances, I didn't hit the co-ed school circuit until our freshman year when we went to high school together. But before then, I was going to middle school dances, and I can remember White Lions, When the Children Cry, and Poison's Every Rose Has Its Thorn, and then this. And these were the three staples of the late 80s middle school dance circuit, in my opinion. And this was really, I thought long and hard about it. Patience was really my ticket into the social world and my first opportunity to locate what some would consider at that age a girlfriend, you know, because she liked Patience too. So I was like, all right. Now, at 4 minutes and 12 seconds into Patience, it seems as if it's coming to a stop. And then it takes a different shape when Slash changes the rhythm and starts that solid strum. And this leads Axl to his famous vocals, "I've been walking the streets at night."
It's such a cool coda.
It is an unbelievably cool coda. And
there's a couple in their resume, right? They've got, you know, they kind of do this to a degree with Paradise City. They do it with Rocket Queen. They do it here.
You're right. They do.
Really cool.
They do, yeah. And those are some of their best songs.
And this is the as geeky guitar as I will get today, but it's two chords, right? It's just D and G.
Yeah.
That's all he's doing.
Yeah.
But it's not a D. It's a D with an F sharp. He's using his thumb on the sixth string. It's an F sharp on the...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Changes the tone. To me, that's there's something that just makes that so much cooler, just that one note.
It still holds up today. I've been listening to it the last couple of weeks, just getting ready for this review, and I fully admit I was in the shower the other day and I was just yelling out, "I've been walking the streets at night. I need you," like all that whole thing, taking me all the way back to, middle school. In fact, many times instead of taking advantage of like, okay, this is now my shot to go up and ask this girl to dance, I would just stand there and do my Axl impression, while everyone was staring at me. So, yeah, okay, a lot of people out there can now get a glimpse. So,
one thing I would say, because I'm not a Matt Sorum fan, but I thought they nailed that live when they did kick the drums in.
I do too, man.
A really good
That's
job
a great that. Point.
My memory is seeing them. I think I went to the show the day after you did in like, what was it, 91 when they came into Worcester or something?
Yes.
The guy next to me, random guy, so we're all standing on our seats, and I look over and he's just crying. And I shouldn't be laughing. For some people, it's like a super emotional, powerful song. And I have this dual thing. I think it's so funny to this day, but at the same time, I get it. You know,
yeah.
Totally in.
Yeah.
Totally in.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was the Guns N' Roses concert in 91. That was the first time that I saw nudity in person. I definitely had. I can remember not thinking the same about life after that night, for sure. Worcester Centrum, December, I think it was December 91, Chris Cornell opened. And
so
after
30 years, almost to the day.
Almost to the day, yep. And after Soundgarden set, Cornell threw his pick out that I caught, and I'm looking at it. I'm staring at it as we speak. So, yeah. Now, the video for Patience was shot at, this was cool, the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. I was always interested to find out where that was. And, you know, back before when this album came out, when the video came out, there was no internet. But the Ambassador Hotel is really cool. It opened in 1921 and it was made famous when Bobby Kennedy was actually assassinated there in 1968. I didn't know any of this. The hotel stayed open until 1988. So after this video was filmed, but then it closed and stayed vacant until it was later demolished in 2006. I just thought that was an interesting piece because they really nailed the atmosphere, I thought, with that. You know, they must have rented out like an entire floor.
Yeah, I think you're right. The video does have a great tone to it, as does the, more importantly, the music.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because it was the time and place where we grew up, but like, that sound, there was a tone to the second side of
Definitely.
The album that I think sounds so cool. And I think that I'm sure they tweaked a lot of it, but a lot of that I think they did do relatively live.
Yeah.
Considering they put it together in a day or two.
Yep.
It's a band that knows what the hell they're doing.
They were very few takes. You're absolutely right. And that's, again, what brought them higher than a lot of other bands, because you had guys like Slash that were, he was hands above in terms of talent a lot of the other guitarists of that genre. And I think it was pretty easy to figure that out, even if you weren't a musician listening to it at the time. So as I mentioned, Patience, it was just a huge song. Before we move on to the next one, it peaked at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, which I was a little surprised. I could have sworn it hit number 1. And that was in 89, but it stayed on the charts in the top 100 charts for almost a year. So as Appetite was still crushing it and Lies was crushing it, it was really the EP Lies rode off the, you know, the anchor was really Patience, what brought it to that next level.
Yeah, this is the only commercial song that came out of it.
Yeah.
There were other reasons that the album was
to we're going to get into that momentarily, but one last thing I did want to mention to you that I can remember the first time, and this is how much of a dork I am, but I can remember the first time I heard the electric version of Patience and being like, you better not mess up, you know, and I was pleasantly surprised when they did it with Matt Sorum and just how they structured it. And so I enjoyed that through the years as I listened to it live as well. It would be cool to hear them play it live, just the acoustic version. Mm. I'm sure there's a recording out there somewhere. Yeah. Here's where Lies gets interesting. The next track, Used to Lover, is another acoustic track and much different from side one and really all of Appetite. But this song is catchy, written perhaps... Here it's where the controversy really starts to bubble, right, Kyle? Like it's not quite all the way up there yet, but it's
giving us a taste of
it. It gives us a little taste.
Domestic murder
appetizer. As a young, again, as we've said a couple of times, as a preteen, I immediately realized these songs' lyrics were dark and disturbed. It opens with the words, "I used to love her, but I had to kill her." That's literally the first, you know, words you hear. Had to put her 6 feet under and I can still hear her complain. I remember turning the volume down because I didn't want my parents to hear this. And my impression was, wow, this is dark. Since Guns N' Roses was so huge at the time, I quickly learned on the playground that it was actually, because again, no internet, it was actually written about Axl's dog. Kyle, do you understand that story to being true, or
I think that this goes to, and you guys cover this on your Faith No More podcast, but I think these band members would just tell any story just to keep, you know, just because they didn't care, right? It's kind of look, if you want to get technical, do you bury dogs 6 feet deep? I don't think I think that they were doing that as, I think that was the joke within the joke. I think this is a it's musically it's fun, it's simple, it's this twangy kind of country feel. It's got a Stones vibe to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the problem with it, the reason it's not, you know, gonna ever be a wonderful song is that it's just kind of really immature.
Yeah.
Right? Like the lyrics are just, the Stones would have never done something that, like lowbrow. You know what I mean? Like it was just directly.
Agreed. The Stones definitely could write songs about, you know, after hours with the women, concerts.
They would have done it more tastefully.
Directly. Yeah. Well, like, you know, someday we'll do a review of Use Your Illusions 1 and 2, but I just... Double Chalk and Jive, the very first lyric of that is, I found an arm and a leg in a garbage can. And that literally happened. There was someone missing and their body was, and anyway, getting dark. I can remember when I heard Used to Love Her thinking, okay, wait, this is really, even though it's about his dog, this is still really disturbing. But Kyle, as you said,
I don't think it's funny.
After digging a little bit deeper, the band did note it was written as a joke and they found the lyrics comical and they just decided to write the song and record it for the EP. So
during that recording session, there's another song that they recorded, which was definitely not on this album. And I can't remember, it's like Cornhole or Cornrow.
Oh, I don't know. I've never heard of this.
Okay, this is not for work. So if you're ever in your office, do not listen to this song. But it was recorded, I believe, in the same session. So they had a series of just super goofy joke songs.
Right.
This was the one that was more appropriate and less controversial than the other stuff, if you can believe that. But
Used to Love Her was?
Yeah, I think that these guys had a sick, immature sense of humor, and it's fine, but it's, I don't know, I think it lessens the song because it's kind of, I don't know, again, Slash does an awesome job. It's a cool little solo.
It really is. It's very toe-tapping. I find it, you know, when you hear a lot more these days, people humming it, right? And so it's sort of become, you know, it. Today, if I was at a party and I was like cooking hot dogs and I was like, I used to love her, but I had to kill. I don't think many people would look at me weird. Whereas when that song first came out, people were like, this guy's a maniac. Who is this person? So I feel like it's, and this is weird to say, but I feel like it's a little bit more acceptable. Whereas a song like this released today, it just purely wouldn't.
Just disappears.
It wouldn't. Yeah. If it, okay. I don't know. I don't hear of a lot of controversial songs anymore that really, really make it big.
It's a contrast. You go from Patience to this one. It's like weird. I mean, they're both acoustic.
Yes.
But
a song about like having patience with your love to then like killing something and burying it, right?
Yeah, I guess patience ended at the end. Yeah.
The controversy, as I was mentioning, it really starts here where I remember the religious right groups and the PMRC, which stood for the Parents Music Resource Center, jumped all over this album. And I have a lot of memories of this. In the late 80s, the PMRC was an organization co-founded by the former second lady to the White House, Tipper Gore. She was one of three founders. And its intentions were to increase, just increase parental awareness around music marketed to the youth that was considered to have, as they described, as violent, drug-related, or sexual themes. So, Kyle, as you can imagine, they put those white parental advisory stickers on there. And what did that do? That made me want it even more. I mean, that
boosted sales.
So a lot of people argue that that was actually a hook, and they weren't really doing that to, they were actually doing that to increase sales, which, you know, whatever. Yeah. I think, yeah. They created that ever so famous parental advisory sticker, which was usually placed over the cellophane wrapper in the bottom left-hand corner, whether it was on cassette, vinyl, or CD. And like I said, did it work? I think a little bit, but also for folks like me, it just made me want the album even more. And I can't recall ever getting denied by a music store owner when trying to buy this. You know, it was like so many other things where it was like, do you have ID? But this, I don't think they ever really tried to. There was really no police officer.
It was parental. It was for parents just to be suspicious.
I guess that was another question I had, is did the music industry ever, you know, put this clause where, you know, record stores had to, but technically it's not illegal, right? So the song Used to Love Her, it really put Guns N' Roses on the PMRC's radar. But the final track on Lies, which we'll get into a little later, One in a Million, made every parent in the country develop a hate campaign for Guns N' Roses, and I will never forget this. Before we talk about it, though, I don't want to forget about the track that follows Used to Love Her, the acoustic version of You're Crazy. Now, Kyle, you and I talked about this song during our Appetite review because it also appears in a heavier, faster form on that record. What do you think about this version compared to the Appetite version?
I think this is my favorite song on Lies. I love it. I think this song just embodies cool.
Yeah.
Everything about it, from his lyrics to his voice, the lazy beat to it. It's got this, I think Steven Adler described it as like, it's a sleazy beat.
Yep.
I love
sleazy
that.
Is a great word.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's just something.
I think it's the best Slash solo on side two.
Yeah. Everything about the song, I think, is just so cool.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. So
you bring, it's a great point. It just oozes coolness. It's slowed down. For those of you that remember the first version, it's acoustic, a bit bluesy, as Kyle said, sleazy. I support my previous statement that I feel that this is the better version. The story goes that this song, Kyle, was written as a response to many groupies that Guns N' Roses were meeting as they grew a little more in fame each month. And it almost sounds like, I was thinking about this the other day, actually, when I was watching her documentary, which, by the way, I recommend. It almost sounds like an Alanis Morissette song in the sense like, you don't want my love, you just want a piece of the action. You know, it's kind of the reverse where the male is, you know, is now, forgive me, Alanis, complaining. I don't want to necessarily say Alanis is a complainer, but it kind of flips things around.
Those
and
poor boys at Guns N' Roses and the things that they had to put up with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were taken advantage of by groupies every night and they never wanted to do it, but by God, they did it for the music. So according to many interviews that I read with the band, You're Crazy would first be recorded in electrical form, but then legend has it, Kyle, that the acoustic version was actually the original version. The electric version, which appears again on Appetite, was sped up about 20 beats per minute from its original. And according to Slash, in his autobiography titled Slash, he said this. So in another interview I saw with Guitar Edge magazine, Slash says, quote, "It was originally a slow acoustic song that we wrote while sitting in the living room one night. Then Axel, Izzy, Duff, and I went down to a rehearsal studio that we were working out of and, of course, turned everything up to 12. All of a sudden, it took on this real breakneck speed. Axel enjoyed actually making the adjustment," end quote. So, Kyle, I found an interview that Axel did with a music newsletter in 88 called Rock Scene, where he said, "The original, quote, the original You're Crazy, the original way it was written was without the curse words. They didn't come into, the curse words didn't come into them until it came on full electric in front of a crowd with some girl where that she was trying to hit me with a beer bottle. And I started directing the words directly at her. That's where the curses happened." So Axel ends up going on to say, "I stamped her head with the bottom of my mic stand and she kept coming at me. I didn't even know her. Nobody in the band knew her. She hit Duff with a beer bottle," end quote.
These are the romantic stories.
Kyle was the first one to bring this up, and I'm glad he did. And I wanted to go back to that little minor tangent about Axel's reputation in the 1980s and early 90s when the band began to be, you know, bigger than anyone. Axel, to me, Kyle, was known as just the baddest dude on the planet. I've said many times that the very first time I laid eyes on him on MTV, that, despite the fact that I had heard music well before and well after, that was the first time where I kind of made up my mind that this was the most important thing. Music, I should say, not necessarily him, but just music. As many crazy things that he did, many kids like me were just drawn to him. Now, I got to say, today, I've changed my mind. I realized also after reading Slash's autobiography, Axel was kind of a narcissist, a little nutty, who, in my opinion, you know, I have to say it, I think he kind of took the band down. It's funny, in Slash's autobiography, he talks a little bit about it, and then I think he probably got scared and didn't want to piss Axl off, so in some chapters he kind of backs away from that. I'd love to know what Axl's like today. I'd love to have a beer with this guy and just see if he'd correct me if I like made a grammatical error in my speech or something like that. Like that, that's kind of the way that he struck me. Like, I want 7 cucumbers sliced after I get off stage. And if there are 6, I'm going to bash your bleeping head in. Like, he was that nutty. But he seems to be calm and kind of more of a team player now. At least I hope. This is my dream.
He shows up on time. That was the big thing. It was him. He never showed up on time, and it pissed everybody off, and it cost
right.
him money.
What was up with that?
I from the books that I've read, that book that we've shared, which you should put yes. on your website.
Okay.
Watch You Bleed. Great. If you're into Guns N' Roses, that's the biography to read. But he was always nuts. But the money and the fame enabled both of those, I think, that craziness.
The insanity to flourish.
And I think you're right. I think he made the band, and it also took it down.
I can remember, Kyle, his tirade in St. Louis in 1990 that caused a huge riot. It was before User Illusions were released. So they started a tour, and MTV covered like the first couple nights. And I remember this was a huge deal. Axl got mad at somebody in the crowd because they had a camera. And he started yelling at the guy. And of course, this guy's like, I'm not going to give away my, you know, $1,000 Nikon or whatever it was. I don't know if it was a Nikon. It could have been a Canon. But I mean, that was the level that Axl got to at that point where he completely flipped out. I believe he jumped into the crowd and then a whole riot started. And so now on the flip side, this kind of, it contributed to that aura. Yeah. And as young kids, you and I, we were sort of like, oh my God, can these guys be any cooler? As creepy and as sort of like annoyed as I was with Axl, because he does later on the next year, he has another tirade that actually affected our opportunity to see him. But it's just, this was really when things started to get crazy. There was the famous incident in Montreal in 92 when the band was co-headlining with Metallica. I'll never forget this. This was like when we heard that these two guys were touring together, it was like, I think I woke up 4 days later. You know, they were touring with Metallica, and Metallica's rhythm guitarist and lead singer James Hetfield got his arm seriously burned by a pyrotechnic on stage in Montreal during their intro to, I think it was One, their hit song at the time. And Metallica had to cut their set short because James got rushed to the hospital with severe burns all over his arm. And all Guns N' Roses had to do, Kyle, to save the day was to come out and just complete a rockin' set. But no, a few minutes into the show, Axl grows frustrated with the sound quality from his monitors. He throws his microphone down, storms off stage, and then the entire stadium starts rioting. Parts of Montreal got burned that night. And even as a generally angry teenager already, this infuriated me. I was like, come on, Axl. This was when my love for Axl kind of began to unravel a little bit, Kyle.
Yeah.
To top it off, when it came time for me to see them, and I'm pretty sure you were there at Gillette. It was not Gillette. It was Foxborough Stadium. I went and saw them at Foxborough Stadium where the Patriots played at the time. And the original show had been canceled because of this, or postponed because of that riot. So when it came time a couple months later to go see the rescheduled show, which, by the way, Faith No More opened up, so it was just boom, 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 Faith No More, Metallica, Guns N' Roses. When it came time for me to see him, Axl sat on the drum riser for about 50% of the show, singing in a fairly monotone voice and not standing until like the very end during Paradise City. So at that point, I was convinced as I was walking back out to the parking lot, this guy was bringing down my favorite band.
Yeah,
so anyway, that was a little bit of a tangent there. Getting back to the album Lies, things get real interesting on the final track on this album titled One in a Million.
Oh, it reminds me, Greg. I gotta go for about like I'm gonna disappear. And you, why don't you cover this one, and then I'll come back. And...
Sure. You're not getting out of this, dude. We're both in this together. I'm gonna keep this podcast as clean as I can, so I won't repeat exactly what some of the song lyrics were. But let's just say, Kyle, if this song was released today, Axel, GNR, and anyone else even remotely associated with the band, even the people that bought it, would get, they'd get canceled, basically. And I'm not trying to knock, I'm not trying to knock any of that. Rightfully so, these lyrics are shocking. But I think what's interesting to talk about more so than the song is just how all this came about. So for those of you listening right now that already don't know this, I'll try to do my best to explain, and Kyle, maybe you can add some color to this.
Nope.
Axl Rhodes, in a few sentences, Axl Rhodes proceeds to insult homosexuals, African Americans, police officers, and immigrants, like within a minute into the song. It was like beyond the trifecta of insults. It was the quadfecta, or whatever it's called. He managed to alienate every minority group out. And what was his motivation? I can remember hearing this as a kid and being like, whoa, like what's going on with Axel? Should we have a seance, or what is that? What is that word? Like, should we have an intervention? I can remember my love for him taking yet another hit. And the main question is, and there are many conflicting stories out there, why did Axel write this, and why didn't the band or the record company Geffen stop him? What do you think?
So this song is unfortunate because musically it's a cool song.
Yeah.
Musically, from a instrumental.
Hum-wise, yes.
I think it's kind of cool. And the chorus is fine. The chorus is cool too.
Yep.
One in a million. I reread the stanzas for this, and there's... And what I had read was every time he would try and explain himself, he kept saying that nobody gets it and that he's not racist and all
right.
that stuff. And I just can't see it.
I can't either. I can't either, but I also don't buy that because I really think he was a smart guy. And because you have to be in order to really take control over a band like
yeah.
that. You have to be a little nutty too, but... So when he says he doesn't know, I mean, I have some thoughts here.
I think he's saying that he's writing this, and I think he was saying it was somebody else's perspective, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It was kind of him.
Yeah.
I don't buy it to this day. I still don't buy it. It still annoys me just because I think it's a bit of a waste what went down. I mean, it turned into a rallying cry for Ku Klux Klan and other far right kind
yeah.
of extreme
yeah.
groups. So, and I don't think he ever owned that. He forced it onto the album. I mean, that's the hill he died on.
Yep.
To make sure that he would not allow that this thing to come out unless that song was out.
Yep. Yep. But
Yeah. Go ahead.
I want you to add on to that if you had something. But you bring up a lot of great points, and this was probably the most interesting song as I dug deeper into it, because I got to admit, as an 11-year-old, I remember hearing it and being like, oh man, this is messed up. This is dark. And I guess as an adult now, maybe I would think twice. I'm looking at a picture right now of Martin Sexton, who's a local Northeastern folk artist, and I love his music and his lyrics. I think if he ever came out on stage and started throwing racial profanity around, I'd be kind of like, whoa, dude, what's, And I think at 11, I was just sort of, maybe to defend ourselves a little bit, I was a little naive, a lot naive, and, perhaps... I don't know. Perhaps maybe I could have looked into deeper, like, why is my favorite band doing this? I wouldn't say I overlooked it. I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, but I kind of was like, oh, that was kind of weird.
Yeah, just moved on.
It's like the weird kid in the room who like makes an outburst and then leaves, and you're all like, so anyway, and you get back
exactly,
to the same.
Exactly.
But what's interesting too, Kyle, is in the final verse, Axel sings, "Radicals and racists, don't point your finger at me. I'm a small town white boy just trying to make ends meet. Don't need your religion. Don't watch that much TV. Just making a living, baby. Well, that's enough for me. Maybe because he said that, and I'm not saying that's what it is for me, but maybe because he ended the song with those lyrics, that the media looked at this as maybe his explanation into the actual song and as to why he wrote it this way.
So I don't know. I spent most of my 18 and a half hour flight thinking, trying to see if there was any light here, and I couldn't find anything. I just think that he's nuts.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good day. That's the end of the podcast.
Yeah, I think it's just unfortunate. And I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah, agreed, agreed. Well, why did he write it? I think many critics say the only reason that they put these lyrics on the record was because it would cause controversy.
Yeah, if he's just manufacturing controversy, which I don't think he was that shallow. I think he thought this stuff, and then he felt like he was recording moments, and that's what he was doing. The book, I don't know why I keep pitching this book, but Watch You Bleed, it's fascinating because throughout the narrative, it's explaining moments of Axl's life where he was in a convenience store that was run by some Iranian immigrants who barely spoke English. They didn't like the way he looked, or maybe he was doing something stupid, which doesn't surprise me at all. They kicked him out of the store. The police came. And so what they were doing was just saying, like, they were giving these, like, images of what this guy went through. This doesn't justify anything, but I think what they were trying to say is, here's where this is coming from.
Right.
And, you know, so Geffen, as a compromise, they made him write a explainer / apology.
Oh my God, that's right. Yes.
And there was a full one. I don't know if you can pull. I don't know. I don't have it written down here. But one of it was on the album cover. And it's not an apology at all. I reread it. I was like, this is the apology that you give to your spouse when you don't really want to apologize. Yeah. This does nothing to help the situation. So yeah, look, I don't know. I my conclusion is that this is an unfortunate lyrical way to wrap up an otherwise very cool EP.
Kyle, I think you've done your homework, man, because I originally did not agree with you, but after digging deeper, it sounds like this is factual. Guns N' Roses vehemently denied that they did this just as a publicity stunt, and they still do to this day. They still get this question asked. Now, I read also that Axl puts like a disclaimer out there to this day. Yes, I will talk to you, but if you even once bring up One in a Million, I'm walking out. Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up a great point. The cover of Lies, the EP, which I just mentioned earlier, was designed as a mock tabloid newspaper, actually contained an advanced apology for the song, as you mentioned. So I guess the band knew it would quickly provoke controversy. But on the cover, there's a small article above the, what I like to call the famous Lies, Lies, Lies part, entitled One in a Million. And if you look deeper, if you read it, the song actually is credited to Axl, and the quote fake articles end with, "This song is very simple and extremely generic or generalized. My apologies to those who may take offense."
Yeah, that's,
end quote.
That's a terrible apology.
It's a horrible apology. But he got away with it. And again, I think, you know, this might be, look at, you know, I don't know, the first thing that pops in my mind right now is Antonio Brown. You know, I'm switching gears here. Antonio plays for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFL. And this guy is it's a fact that this guy's done some shady stuff. And yet NFL teams still hire him. They still pay him. So, you know, are we accusing Axl necessarily of a crime? No. I mean, he's definitely he could be in jail for previous assault and batteries before, but like that girl we were talking about earlier. But it's interesting how these guys just got away with it back then. Or maybe they went to jail, but of course they had millions and millions of dollars so they could be bailed out, and they had high quality lawyers.
When I was thinking about it, I went back and saw some interviews by some of the rap artists of the time. So yeah. You get like Ice Cube, I think. I think he played with Ice Cube a couple times. And Ice Cube defended him.
Yeah, you're right. This is coming back to me now.
A lot of the bands defended him. It's kind of funny. They had those like grim looks on their face. They were like, freedom of speech. Like,
yeah.
I don't like it, but it's freedom of speech.
Right, right. Yeah.
Everybody just kind of walked away from it after that. But you know, the one thing that did stick out to me was the chorus, because it's my understanding is that it's kind of about the way his friends back home see him. You're one in a million. You're a shooting star.
Yep.
Oh no, you're one in and.
Yeah, no, you're right.
That's who you are.
That's who you are. You're a shooting.
Someday we'll see you before you make us cry.
Yeah.
We tried to reach you, but we were much too high. It's to me, in some ways, like that's sort of the coda of the entire band.
Yep, absolutely, man. Yep,
it's a cool little chorus. Unfortunately, and there's things with some cool guitar work to it, but yeah, those lyrics really do ruin the song.
Yeah, in his final public comments about One in a Million in 1992, apparently he made his final public comments. Axl stated, quote, "It was a way for me to express my anger at how vulnerable I felt in certain situations that had gone down in my life," end quote. So what I also read was that he had a couple of experiences. I don't know exactly what they were, but I think one of them included like getting beat up or a robbery or something like that. And so anyway, you mentioned something earlier, Kyle, you hit the nail on the head. It was a reaction to an experience that he had. Yeah. And he just decided, like, I want to fight for this and put it on the record. Before the release of the EP, other members of the band, interestingly, desperately tried to convince Axl to drop the track from the record. So I didn't know this. Which, again, this fact leaves me thinking Axl had a lot more power than we originally thought. So Slash, or as many of you may know, his original name, Saul Hudson, whose mother is African-American, Slash noted that he did not overlook the song, but did not slam Axl for writing it and putting it on the EP. And in 91, in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, Slash says, quote, "When Axl first came up with the song and really wanted to do it, I said I didn't really think it was cool. I don't regret doing One in a Million. I just regret what we've been through because of it and the way people have perceived our personal feelings," end quote.
I love the non-apology.
No, once again, right? So I got to wonder how that went down, right? Maybe Slash feels guilty now about maybe not fighting harder for it, or, you know, it's like kind of back then you're like, whatever, dude, I'm not going to take offense to it because I'm just not going to let that, you know, but that's messed up.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the rise of the dictator of the band, and everybody else in the band's unwillingness to get into conflict. They just said, they threw their hands up and they started drinking and doing more drugs.
Kind of a heads down mentality.
The two albums, we'll call this an album, it's not, but Appetite and this EP, I think really makes up the best part of what this band produced.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, I think, was them just on this crazy momentum, this kind of bloated mega star adventure, and with this dictator in charge.
It really was.
It does bum me out because I love both of these projects, right? Lies obviously has its gaps.
Yeah.
To know that this is as good as the band will ever be, kind of, that you just have to kind of take it for what it is.
Right? Yeah, it's interesting how we have the same perspective. I guess it's not interesting. It doesn't surprise me at all. In 88, Izzy Stradlin told another rock magazine that, quote, "The lyrics simply reflected the poor race relations of inner city Los Angeles at the time," end quote. Well, okay, I found that interesting. Again, maybe a non-apology apology, again, the third one. In a 2019 interview, and this is kind of, over the years, I got to say, and I follow him on Instagram now, I've really regained my liking of Duff McKagan. He's really been upfront about his alcohol, specifically his alcohol abuse, but also his drug abuse, but he really had serious alcohol problems, and you know, whether or not it's a load of BS, he really seems to come off as a guy who's like, I'm reborn. My family is my most important thing. I mean, there's videos of him now, if you follow him on Instagram, where he's playing with his puppy or he's, you know, hanging with his daughter or whatever, you know, okay, whether that's for the camera or not. But Duff says in his autobiography, One in a Million, was misinterpreted as, one thing about Axl is if you're going to try to compete with him intellectually, you've lost, because he's a super smart guy. He's a super sensitive dude who does his studies. When we did that song, I was still drinking, but he was way ahead of us with his vision of something's got to be said. This was the most hardcore way to say it. So flash forward to now, so many people have misinterpreted that song that we removed it. Nobody got it. And what Duff's referring to is the box set reissue of Appetite for Destruction when they reissued it in 2018, which included the Lies EP as a bonus. But this time around, the band left One in a Million off of the box set. Probably a smart thing to do in today's day and age. I don't know. What do you think?
Look, well, I think what he's saying is, you know, none of you people understand the brilliance of Axl Rose, and so therefore we're going to take it off of the album and we'll never play it or talk about it again. That'll show you. Yeah, I still don't buy the whole thing. I think that's it's bad idea.
Yeah, the album Lies reached number 2 on the U.S. top 200 Billboard charts, and according to the RIAA, which is the Recording Industry Association of America, the album has shipped over 5 million copies in the United States. I gotta believe it's higher than that. These were some recent numbers that I looked up, but I gotta believe it's way higher than 5 million. Notwithstanding its controversy, the music on Lies, Kyle, I think we can agree, it's superb. You know, the writing of the music. I enjoyed going through this recording, reliving it, for what's probably been close to 25 or 30 years since I really listened to the whole thing front to back. So it really brought me back to being a kid sitting in my bedroom, just staring out into the woods behind my house, listening to this and just thinking about what, you know, what my life was like and what the direction it was going to go in. For back then, you know, what's cool about being a kid, despite the fact that it's confusing, there's a lot of unknown, a lot of uncertainty, and I think a lot of excitement. And despite the fact that I'm very happy with how my life has turned out, you know, I want to say sometimes it's interesting to go back and think about that excitement, that uncertainty, because you didn't really know how things were going to turn out. And I'm lucky enough to say that, you know, I had enough opportunities where I guess from an innocence standpoint, it brought me back and brought back some of those good memories.
Yeah, look, I think this little album is, it leads us into what Appetite was becoming, and then it takes us a little bit down the road to where things went afterwards. And it's just a fun, I use that word again, it's bookends. It's the bookends of the Appetite era.
It's a great description.
It's a fun way to get your head around all of the chaos and punk rock blues mayhem that they had created in that era. So,
yeah.
It's fun little batch of music.
And any album that takes me back in time, it reminds me too of how when I used to listen to music, I think good music breeds imagination and creativity. And I think those are some of the most important things as a child, because in many ways, as you grow older, you know, you can turn some of that into reality. So, Kyle, we're getting close to wrapping things up here, but is there anything that you wanted to add about this album or the review before we start to close it in?
I've said my piece.
Yeah, you sure have, man. I appreciate your insight into this album, and I got to give you full props. This was your recommendation. Kyle emailed me from Singapore and said, let's get together, let's do Lies. And I was like, great idea. And then I fell out of my chair when he blew me away with the next great idea was, and I'm coming to town and let's do it live.
Live like a suicide.
Live like a suicide. So I still got to go back up and fix that chair at some point too, because I completely fell out of it. A big thank you again to Kyle Hegarty for joining me on this special live in the studio podcast episode.
You got to pump in some audience noise.
Yeah. but from another recording, not from something we did. So glad to have you visiting from Singapore, Kyle. So good to have you back in the hood. back where it all began. Remember, you guys, you can get a copy of Kyle's book. Little plug here quickly before we finish. Kyle's book, The Accidental Business Nomad, A Survival Guide for Working Across a Shrinking Planet. You can get it on Amazon. You can also get it by going to the bookstore in albumreview.net. Kyle, thanks again, man. This album review... I can't say this seriously. I was going to say, this album review is definitely one in a million. Well, I've had 17 cups of coffee, and I haven't had food since like 8 o'clock this morning, so I need some food, and I'm going to look forward to reminiscing again a little bit more with Kyle. You guys have a great rest of your night, morning, evening, afternoon, whatever you're doing listening to this, but I'm just really excited to have had this conversation again with Kyle. So thank you again.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you again for listening to the albumreview.net podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kyle Hegarty and our album review of Guns N' Roses' 1988 EP, GNR Lies. I think we tried our best to equally voice our love for this record, in addition to our disappointment over the band keeping the controversial lyrics in the record's final track, One in a Million. Many of you guys may remember in 1988, GNR was in fact the biggest band in the world, so it was a lot of fun learning more about this EP. Remember, if you're interested in any of the albums I've discussed in this episode or previous episodes, go to albumreview.net and pick up a copy of your own. Listen to all of my podcast album reviews at albumreview.net by clicking on the podcast tab. They can also be heard wherever podcasts are available. All right, lastly, I do want to hear from you guys. Please email me your feedback, album review requests, and any questions that you have to gpotters@albumreview.net. That's gpotters at albumreview.net. Stay tuned for updates on Instagram and Facebook. You can find me at albumreview.net. Join the mailing list, which is on the homepage of the website, or just keep refreshing your podcast feed. Just read and listen. Thanks again, guys. Keep on listening, keep on reading, and keep on learning. Now take some advice from my companion here.
Do me a favor, please. Get out of here. Get out of here, man.
Take a trip down by the highway. 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 Take a trip down by my highway.